Here with It Says in the Papers is John S. Doyle.
New COVID-19 restrictions expected to be announced today after a specially convened cabinet meeting are the main topic for most papers. It will be level 4 plus nationwide for 3 to 4 weeks, says the Irish Times. The paper quotes one minister as saying there is general agreement that schools should remain open no matter what. That was also the view of the National Public Health Emergency Team, NPHET, the unnamed source said. November pain, says the Irish Daily Star headline, predicting a revised level 4 lockdown. Lockdown will save Christmas, says the Irish Daily Mail. For our own good is the headline in the Irish Sun, which spells it F-O-U-R. The paper reckons that all pubs are set to shut and schools could be closed. Dawn of a new lockdown, says the lead headline in the Irish Independent. The paper believes that schools and creches will remain open and describes what is in prospect as a merger of level 4 and level 5 restrictions set out in the government's Living with COVID-19 strategy. It is expected, Philip Ryan writes, that the three government leaders with their senior ministers, who meet Tony Houlihan and Paul Reid this morning, will reject NPHET's suggestion of a 6-week lockdown and instead opt for between 3 and 4 weeks. As for the reason for all these restrictions, the Irish Daily Mirror reports in its lead story on what it calls a super spreader who infected at least 56 people after catching COVID-19 abroad. As revealed in a report published by the Health Service Executive Midwest, the man failed to self-isolate, leading to 10 households and players on a sports team getting coronavirus. That story is carried in detail on the front page of The Times as well. The case is described by the HSE as a real example of how COVID-19 can quickly spread within the community. The Irish Examiner leads with a report that there are now almost 200 fewer permanent nurses working in the health system than before the pandemic. The Labour Party leader, Alan Kelly, is quoted describing the figures as absolutely shocking in the middle of a global pandemic. Phil Nihay of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation said there was simply no excuse for not employing permanent staff. The Belfast Telegraph leads with the tributes paid to 18-year-old Josh Fletcher from Moira, County Down, who died yesterday after his car left the road when it struck a cow. On the matter of linguistics and spelling, a letter to the editor of The Independent makes a singular and short point. Thanks for putting fathers on Irish words. The articles read much better with them. So writes Áine Monaghan, address with editor, who has given her a capital A father.
And all eyes on the government today as the country waits to hear what additional strict new measures will be imposed to tackle the continuing rise in COVID-19 numbers. The country's already at level 3 with visits to other households discouraged. Cavan Monaghan and Donegal already at 4. So how far will they go today? Level 4 everywhere or follow the NPHET advice to a full 6-week level 5 lockdown? What about construction sites, creches and schools? What about sport and the GAA Championship? Here to tell us more of what this day will bring is our political correspondent Paul Cunningham. We know, Paul, that they're going to act. They're going to act decisively because Minister Simon Harris has said so. So how will this day unfold?
Well, there's some things we do know. First of all, we know something about the plan of meetings. There's going to be a subcommittee meeting of cabinet, and that's going to involve the three coalition party leaders, plus the ministers for health, finance, public expenditure, and Simon Coveney, foreign affairs as well. And they're going to effectively try and narrow differences because there are still outstanding differences on the approach to take. And that's probably going to start sometime between 10 and 11 and go on for 2 or 3 hours. Then they're going to draft up a proposal which will go to cabinet. And I think the earliest that could happen at would be 2, more likely 3, mid-afternoon. And then there's going to be a full cabinet meeting in which they have to decide on this decisive plan. And that's going to run on for quite some time because there are many, many questions left about what they're going to do. So I think it's probably more likely it's going to be 9 o'clock tonight before the Taoiseach Micheál Martin walks down the steps of government buildings to tell us what his plan is.
How decisive will decisive be?
I think it's pretty clear that they're going to really raise the stakes now. We are going to go to at least a level four, if not elements of level five included. I think effectively it's going to be this so-called level four plus. But just exactly what measures are contained inside that, we don't know. So, for example, here's some questions that are still outstanding rather than decisions that the Cabinet's going to make. We don't know, for example, how long these new restrictions are going to last. Will it be 4 weeks or will it be 6 weeks with a possible 3 week review? We don't know what their definition of essential work is going to be. People who can continue to work despite the restrictions being put in place, like, for example, will construction be included in this? What is an appropriate bubble? How many people can visit homes? We know that there was a particular emphasis from government to make sure that people who were living alone would get social visits, that they wouldn't be isolated. What is that going to mean in this new level four plus? And what is an appropriate distance for people to stay? Under level five, it's 5 kilometres. Could it be 10 kilometres, given that we know that schools and colleges, they're a priority and that they're going to stay open? And then what about those financial supports, the things the opposition parties have been talking about a lot? Will there be mortgage payment breaks like we did have in the early days of March and April? Will the PUP payment be restored to €350? Those types of questions. So all of that material, all of those questions still remain to be answered. And that's why I think there's an awful lot to be discussed, both in the subcommittee and full cabinet. And it's going to take some time before they've got it resolved, because there are clearly different views on these matters.
Another point as well, Paul, what about enforcement? Could we see some new measures around enforcement?
Well, on enforcement, there was due to be a cabinet meeting on Tuesday, tomorrow, in which they were going to look at graduated penalties, in other words, code for on-the-spot fines. They felt that going to court would be too cumbersome, and particularly if you're in level four and five, there mightn't be any courts. Now, as I understand, there's still active engagement on that issue between the Departments of Health and Justice. It hasn't been finalised, but it could be finalised today, or it could be left until tomorrow. But even if it isn't finalised until tomorrow, I think people will want to know what is going to happen if people don't buy into this plan, if they don't actually do what they're supposed to do, because there is a clear sense that the sort of we're all in this together feeling in March and April isn't the case today as we stand.
Another question though, whether it's level four, four plus, or level five, they need a plan to how we get back out from this. How are we going to get out of a lockdown?
I think that's absolutely crucial, Mary. I think they have to communicate a few things. What is the plan? Explain the logic of having a hybrid plan of level four and level five. Why not do what their own plan says and go for one rather than the other? They have to be able to explain, you know, what is success going to look like, to quote Simon Harris? What is it that we're trying to achieve? And then, as you just mentioned there, how we're going to step down from these restrictions so that there's some form of like an aim we want to get there. I mean, the Fine Gael ministers having a conference call yesterday morning, and one of the key things they had was that they had to secure public buy-in when they announced these new measures, and they also needed to communicate a sense of hope and confidence. And I think that will only flow from if people know what's involved, what they have to do, but also, as you said, how we're going to get out of it and maybe break that cycle of opening and closing the economy.
All right, Paul Cunningham, our political correspondent for now. Thank you very much. Much more to come on what's ahead today, including Minister Thomas Byrne and the Sinn Féin President Mary Lou MacDonald.
And we are joined now by Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, consultant in critical care medicine at the Mater Hospital in Dublin and president of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland. Good morning, Dr. O'Loughlin.
Good morning, Audrey.
You're very welcome to the programme. Last night, as we were reporting, 290 people in hospital with COVID, 31 of them in ICU. How would you characterise the hospitalisations and the admissions to ICU at the moment, steadily rising?
The hospital's numbers seem to be steadily rising at a slow rate, but it's quite steady. The ICU numbers are a little bit more difficult to interpret. Over the last week, they've been quite stable. For example, over the last 24 hours, there's been 4 admissions. But also, don't forget that a lot of these patients get better in ICU and leave, and so we had 4 discharges. So the numbers have balanced out in intensive care. So it's a little bit more difficult to interpret those. But overall, it's certainly worrying for a slow rise across the sector. And I suppose in projection terms, that's the major concern. The rate of this rise is the real concern. We don't know what that will be. And anything that can kind of slow that rate of rise is probably obviously a benefit to the hospital sector.
And I suppose the important question then is, what is capacity like at the moment? How many free ICU beds are there across the public health system this morning?
As this morning, there's approximately 40 beds. I looked up the system just a few minutes back in the intensive cares. They're spread all over the country. And I suppose that's also reflective of the fact that over the last week, more cases of COVID presenting to ICUs have come up all over the country as well. So there's a bit of capacity in the system at the moment. There are some hospitals who are disproportionately affected by this just by the layout of those hospitals. Not all hospitals and ICUs have the same geographical layout. But there are some who are struggling with that aspect of it. But there are a lot of hospitals who are expecting this today and all of this week to perform as normal as they would have done this time last year and carry on with all the major activities that go on in the hospital. So as things stand, that's still achievable, which is very, very important. So we're full across the sector, more or less, in a lot of the major ICUs anyway. But again, that's a normal situation for ICUs over the last 30, 40 years in intensive care. We've always been full, and we discharge patients on the basis of new patients coming in, so it's often the case that we are full. But we are coping at the moment,
and we all hope and pray that there will be no surge this time round in this second wave of the pandemic. But if there was to be a surge, what capacity is there in ICU? What can you do to increase the number of ICU critical care beds?
We have fairly well laid out plans as to where we can put surged patients. So these are patients who where the capacity goes beyond what current intensive care capacity allows. So every hospital has identified spaces for those patients to go into. All those spaces have been well kitted out with the relevant equipment, including ventilators. So we have identified over 100 extra beds that people can go into fairly quickly if we do surge above normal capacity. The concern lies around the staffing for those beds, and what we don't have a clear number on is how many extra staff will be available to staff those beds. ICU staffing is quite intensive, pardon the pun, but is intensive care for that reason. So you need 6 nurses to open up 1 bed, and that is a concern. They don't necessarily exist in the community. They have to be trained up. Intensive care nursing is a 6-month training program with another 6 months of kind of work experience to get to the level of a independent practitioner, if you like, of intensive care nursing. So it's a difficult road to travel, looking into surge, largely because of staffing, not necessarily because of actual geographical bed space capacity that's there. It's just we don't know how many nurses we have, and indeed doctors and allied health professionals to staff those beds should we go there.
But we were told at the height of the first wave that there were over 500 ICU beds available. Were they not all staffed?
No, that's a simple answer. These are all potential beds, and I think that's important. So the HSC were very involved early on trying to get a kind of surge plan per hospital and collate all those plans into one kind of national database of potential spaces. But they genuinely are just that, potential spaces. I can show any person who's interested a walk around the Mater Hospital and show people where those beds are and where those ventilators are. But what I can't find is the staff necessarily to staff those beds. It is a huge task even to think about finding the number of staff to efficiently run those beds. So we're talking about nurses who may never have worked intensive care before, have been asked to come in and help out. A lot of these people would have training during March, April, May and June. That all slowed down, of course, because they all went back to their baseline roles in the hospital as of July when we fully opened up again. And it's not necessarily straightforward to get them back again in for training because they are continuing to do those baseline jobs. So, for example, if I had to take a nurse who's currently working in the kind of post-operative care unit after theatre, that's busy at the moment, so we can't take them out of there. and expect that service to run normally to train them. So there's a lot of challenges. The HSE are aware of them and they're trying to come around solutions and fund.
But of course, not all of those ICU beds were needed. The ICU reached nowhere near that level of capacity first time round.
Oh, thankfully not. No, it was a blessing. We got away with it in that sense. Certainly, every patient pretty much was catered for within existing ICU capacity. But for that to have happened, a huge amount of sacrifice was made by patients who were scheduled for surgery at the time, and talking about cardiac, cancer, vascular surgeries, and a lot of others. They all were all postponed, and they've had to make huge sacrifices. It happened largely because of a huge amount of effort by the public to flatten the curve, as they call it, and it really dramatically reduced transmission rates in the community. So we saw a fairly sudden cessation of ICU admissions around the end of April, start of May, largely because the virus transmission was flattened.
Exactly. So to that end, you think it is now time to increase restrictions?
Yes, I mean, you know, we're being kind of putting out a message that we can care for these patients better than before. That's not necessarily the case either. You know, a lot of the drugs that we use, we don't know if they're that good at treating this virus thus far. So we're back to kind of supportive medication and supportive therapies in the ICU. And what is known and what we've proven the last time is that reduction of virus transmission in the community is the only proven way to reduce hospital and ICU admissions. But we're missing one major factor this time around, I think, and that's the fear factor. And that's why I think I support anything that will reduce virus transmission in the public. But what I am noticing, and this is not me necessarily speaking from intensive care hat or ICSI hat, it's just an observer in the community that, whereas in March, if I was walking down the street, people just crossed the road to wish me well. There was a fear factor there that's not there now. So moving to level 3 to 4 to 5 is only useful if it gets the compliance that's needed. So yes, I'm hopeful that if we do move to these levels of increased restrictions, that the effect of those will be seen and the compliance will improve to get that effect. Because if we don't get the effect, the restrictions won't mean anything.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, consultant in critical care medicine at The Mater and president of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland.
This week marks the 100th anniversary of the death of the Lord Mayor of Cork, Terence McSwinney, who died on hunger strike. It was to be another turning point in a tumultuous year in the War of Independence that saw violence and reprisals increase. By the year's end, much of the centre of Cork City had been set ablaze and reduced to ruins. Donal Byrne reports.
Cork City and County in 1920 had one of the most organised and best equipped IRA structures in the country, mounting numerous attacks against and assassinations of police and military personnel. As the leader of the Cork No. 1 Brigade, Terence McSwinney was an obvious target for security forces, notwithstanding his position as Lord Mayor. His predecessor, Tomás McCurtain, had been murdered in his home in the Blackpool area of Cork City. McSwinney knew the risks he ran. Dr. John Borgonovo of University College Cork.
McSwinney was not as charismatic as Tomás McCurtain, but he expressed himself pretty well on paper. He had been a dramatist, he had written plays, he'd written poetry. But he also seemed to recognize that he was probably next in line, not just for the authority, but also possibly for assassination. And he seemed to have been preparing his own kind of obituary.
After being convicted of sedition, McSwinney joined a hunger strike at Cork Prison by many prisoners being held without trial. He alone was moved to Brixton Prison in London. While McSwinney's name dominated this period, the others on hunger strike in Cork, including two who died, Michael Fitzgerald and Joe Murphy, were eclipsed in history. Joe Kenny was one of the hunger strikers. His grandson, Conor Kenny, is writing a book to redress that wrong.
As regards McSwinney, like, he was the Lord Mayor. The spotlight was bound to be on him. And then again, Joe Murphy died, he was only 25. Michael Fitzgerald died, he was only 34. They were just plain men of the Irish race who were ordinary men who did extraordinary things. And I think they should be remembered.
His cousin Claire Cronin has helped in the writing of the book.
How do you talk about something that cuts you to the core? The men who died were real martyrs. It's just that because these nine carried on for a record 94 days. It just, they do need recognition, really.
McSweeney died in prison after 74 days. It was a propaganda coup for Republicans and arguably radicalised many more people in Cork and elsewhere in the country. After his death, his wife Muriel campaigned in America and then moved to France. Their only child, Moira, was sent to Germany to be educated. The estrangement of mother and daughter lasted until Muriel's death. In later years, Moira reflected on her relationship with her mother.
Does it sadden me? No. That may seem odd, but I was never with her. I felt afraid of her, not sad. She was very unpredictable. There was no telling what she'd do next. I just wanted to be left in peace.
And that was a voiced version of one of Moira Brua McSweeney's last interviews. And you can see Donal Byrne's nationwide programme about Terence McSweeney on RTÉ One Television this evening at 7 o'clock. It's 29 minutes past 7.
Instagram is being investigated by Ireland's Data Protection Commissioner over its handling of children's personal data on the platform. The app's owner, Facebook, could face a large fine if Instagram is found to have broken privacy laws. The investigations stem from complaints that Instagram made contact information on business accounts publicly visible to anyone accessing the app. Average house prices rose by 4.8% between June and September this year, according to the latest house price report from daft.ie. House prices rose by 11% in Waterford City, 10% in Galway City and 9% in Cork and Limerick cities. By comparison, prices rose by 2.2% in Dublin. The number of homes on sale is at a 14-year low, which has helped increase prices. A growing number of people are being subjected to financial abuse since COVID restrictions were implemented, according to research published this morning by the Banking and Payments Federation and Safeguarding Ireland. During lockdown, many people needed assistance to manage their money or access funds. Two-thirds of people who needed help from others to manage their money during lockdown have not yet taken back control of their own finances. One in 20 experienced financial abuse during lockdown. On the currencies, €1 buys 90.5 pence sterling and $1 17 cents.
Now it's time for sport with Darren Frehill. And I think over the weekend, Darren, are we getting used to seeing sport without the crowds?
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of nearly a given at this stage, isn't it, Mary? I think after 7 months now, we're finally getting our heads around that, the no atmosphere type of thing, and people are listening on the radios and watching on the couches. And there was certainly a huge amount of action taking place over the weekend across all the codes. The big focus was on the Gaelic Games, wasn't it? A break of 7 months and the inter-county football season resumed. Lots of debate about whether it should be going ahead or not, and I know there could be developments later today, but under that cloud of COVID-19, we certainly got some great action and lots of talking points as well. I think the performance of the weekend goes to Mayo. They beat Galway by 15 points in Division 1. Donegal got the better of Tyrone, and that result keeps Donegal safe. Mayo will still have to wait until next weekend to ensure their safety, still in danger of going down to Division 2. Wins for Clare and Kildare in Division 2. And Division 2 is fascinating because there's just 4 points between the team in first and seventh place, and then just one round of games to go. The news not so good, as we know, for the team in eighth place. Fermanagh relegated. They lost to Clare, but they were without 17 squad members because of COVID-19. This is one of the stories that dominated the sports headlines last week. And as you'd expect, their manager, Ryan McMenamin, cut a very disappointed figure when he spoke to Mike McCartney.
Probably been the story of our season. It's one that got away again. We had great chances in the first half, missed three or four bad frees. We had a couple of chances that then just we hit the post, and if we'd have just been just chipping the scores away like we were meant to do, I think we probably would have won that game, and we conceded a very, very soft goal. But look, all in all, with the preparation that I had, I'm immensely proud of the lads. I'm immensely proud of the three boys that made their debut, Josh Largo, Luke Flanagan, Sean McNally and Nets. They didn't look at a step. I think They hadn't done a lot of prep. Players like Owen Donnelly, savage game. He hasn't got a lot of work done that day. To me, he was immense today.
After you were told the game couldn't be postponed and the request was turned down, were you hurt by that?
I wasn't hurt. I was always expecting that answer, so we just planned ahead. We knew it was always going to go this way, and we said, look, we just had to dust ourselves down. And if I took everything personally, I don't think I'd come out through the house, maybe what's been written about me or said about me down through the years. So I'm kind of over that. But no, the boys dusted down, got ourselves sorted then, and we put in three real great nights training, and I'm annoyed that we lost the game, and annoyed that it's probably now maybe third game maybe we should have won if it had our shooting boots on. But look, I think if you looked at everything else around, a lot of other teams have had a lot more prep than us, and they've got bigger beatings. It's just maybe time for the Fermanagh lads, and even maybe they undersell themselves too much, and I've been harping on about that there. And to me, it was a fantastic performance for them. But look, we didn't win, so we're going up the road with our tails between our legs, and we're just going to have to dust ourselves down and prepare for Leash.
I'm sure they will. Now, there's also trouble brewing in Division 3. Tipperary beat Offaly 116 to 16 points. Great game, this big win for Tip, but not everyone happy in the Tipperary camp. Their manager, David Power, wonders why Leitrim were allowed to concede their game against Down over the weekend because of COVID. Now, they went on record saying that they had to withdraw because they were waiting on test results, but there was no specific detail given. The sides meet next weekend. David Power had some very strong words for Damien Lawler and Thurles yesterday.
I think the whole integrity of the league is damaged after what Leitrim did yesterday. I think there was no mention of how many cases or anything like that. I thought it was very, very poor to be given a walkover. If I was Derry, I'd be very, very upset as well, because not only did it affect the bottom of the league, it certainly affected the top of the league. I think there's a lot of people very, very disappointed in what happened. And look, at the end of the day, we'll be going up to Leitrim, but if they are in isolation, the rules are 14 days, so how are they going to be able to play next weekend?
Try and get more clarification.
Yes, absolutely. So look, obviously it's all hinging on probably next Sunday, but it is just disappointing. I don't know, like, for that to happen yesterday, it's after leaving a very, very sour taste in a lot of people's mouths for that to happen, because to be happening at inter-county level, like, we were after having many issues over the last couple of weeks. We had close contacts, and lucky enough there was no positive cases. But like, Fermanagh, as far as I know, went down with 18 men down to Clare. So are you telling me that Leitrim couldn't get 15 to 20 players to play against Down?
Now, in Division 4, Wexford beat Limerick to get their promotion hopes back on track. In hurling, Antrim overcame Kerry by 3 points. They won the Division 2A title, so they're back to Division 1. Down overcame Derry in the 2B decider. Sligo beat Leitrim in the Division 3B final. In the Littlewoods Camogie Championship, wins for Galway and Tipperary. In last night's Premier League action, West Ham produced quite the comeback to earn a 3-3 draw with Tottenham. Tottenham 3-0 up with 8 minutes to go. Somehow West Ham clawed their way back into this game. Spurs manager Jose Mourinho put on a brave face after the game.
For me, it's much easier to praise their belief than to be critic with us. What happened? Happened football? In football, this is possible. But I have to admit that it's strange to explain, because the game was totally under control, and then one lateral free kick brings them to the game, let's say that. And then we must have the personality, the determination to keep it safe until the end. But, you know, this goal happens once in a lifetime, in the last second, incredible shot. That's football.
That is football. Aston Villa also had a late win against Leicester City, 1-0 there. Shelburne are all but safe. 1-0 victory against Sligo Rovers last night in the Premier Division. In the WSL, Katie McCabe scored a cracker as Arsenal beat Tottenham 6-1. Jason Cochrane won the CJ Cup. Roy McIlroy just outside the top 20. And Adrian Ogatagi won the Scottish Championship on 23 under par. Good finish for Jonathan Caldwell. He was in a tie for 7th place. Best of the Irish there, and his best European Tour finish ever. I'm back in an hour's time.
The US presidential election is just 2 weeks away. Voting's tomorrow fortnight. There is much focus on the key swing state of Pennsylvania. Donald Trump won the state by the tiniest of margins last time round, helping him to secure the White House. This time round, he's under pressure in the polls in a state that his opponent Joe Biden used to call home. So in the first of a series of reports looking ahead to the election, our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan travelled to the so-called Rust Belt of Pennsylvania to see if voters there will be backing Donald Trump once again in November.
This is a story of action in the yards of Bethlehem Steel Company.
The steel plant in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, made parts for the Golden Gate Bridge and the Hoover Dam, as well as the mighty U.S. battleships that fought in World War II.
Bethlehem's entry into shipbuilding was a significant move.
Today, the Bethlehem steel plant lies idle and abandoned, having closed years ago. Its enormous rusting smokestacks and blast furnaces dominate the skyline.
Your steel is coming back. Those plants are going to be opening.
Donald Trump has long promised to bring industries like steel and coal back to Pennsylvania.
We're putting our steel workers back to work at clips that nobody would believe. Right?
The so-called Rust Belt vote used to be solidly Democrat, but this area flipped and went for Donald Trump back in 2016. It helped him to win the state of Pennsylvania and the White House by the tiniest of margins, but now he's under pressure in the polls here and nationally.
I believe that Pittsburgh and my native town of Scranton and my home.
Joe Biden was born in working-class Scranton, Pennsylvania, and is seen by many in this state as one of their own.
Quite frankly, folks, if I'm going to be able to beat Donald Trump in 2020, it's going to happen here. It's going to happen here in western Pennsylvania.
Chris Borick is a professor of political science at Pennsylvania's Muhlenberg College.
Most of the polls in Pennsylvania show it in kind of a mid-single-digit range for Biden. That's been pretty consistent throughout the year. In 2016, indeed, the polls showed that Hillary Clinton was winning Pennsylvania. The final average right before Election Day was under 2 points, though. It was 1.9 in the national and the averages of the Pennsylvania polls. President won by less than 1%. So certainly it was slightly overstated, but perhaps not as much as people think. If Joe Biden has a lead in early November in mid-single digits in Pennsylvania, I think that's a pretty hard number for the president to overcome, not impossible.
What does your gut tell you? Who's going to win on November 3rd?
Yeah, I think probability leans in Pennsylvania towards Joe Biden. I think he has some advantages here. I think it's harder terrain for the president this time around.
Sir, are you a Bethlehem voter? I'm running for the 135th Legislative District.
In downtown Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Scott Hoff is out on the canvas. He's a Republican candidate running to become a state representative.
When you are out campaigning, do people bring up Donald Trump a lot and his performance in office?
Some folks do. Some folks will slam the door in your face and not even want to talk to you because you have the title Republican after your name. But, you know, the majority of people in Bethlehem, the overwhelming majority of people in Bethlehem, I would say, are very fair-minded, hardworking people. And they are willing to have a conversation. And that's why I'm running, because I feel that's something we're lacking right now in our country, is people sitting down, having a conversation, and just trying to find common ground.
A mix of Donald Trump and Joe Biden lawn signs line the residential streets of this Pennsylvania town, and it's a divide that's reflected in the views of voters here.
So where we live, there was like one Clinton Kane sign in the entire neighborhood, and now there are at least as many Biden signs on front yards as there are Trump signs. So it's a big difference from 4 years ago.
You voted Donald Trump back in 2016, yes, and you're happy with that decision, and you are happy with the way the country is going.
I think he's doing a very wonderful job. I think he's the most knowledgeable president we've had in my lifetime. And he's quite courageous. And I think we're going in the right direction, and I hope that people give him another 4 years.
I had hopes for Donald Trump, but I don't think he's come through, and I like Joe Biden.
What has disappointed you most about Donald Trump over the last 4 years?
Oh, all the lies and all the circumvention that he has done, and he's just not a very honest man.
I'm going to vote for Trump. I like the fact that he doesn't hold back. I mean, I also hate the fact that he's on social media as much as he is. He's unfiltered and uncensored, and he's not listening to what his press secretary is telling him to say. But I also like that about him, too, because nobody's in his pockets, and he does what he says.
The polls have him behind in Pennsylvania and behind nationally, but do you think Donald Trump can do it?
Actually, I do. I do. I think he's got he's a smart businessman, and this is business.
Donald Trump's victory here was forged in the shadows of abandoned steel mills and coal mines. Many who voted for him probably knew deep down that he was never really going to reopen those industries, but backed him anyway. Here's Professor Chris Borick again.
The messaging, the idea that he could return to these eras of good memories and strong economic performance certainly was part of his message. Has coal returned to Scranton? No. Has steel returned to Bethlehem? No. But his broader messaging, I think, even with that failure, if you will, to return those things, still resonates with a lot of voters.
We all can face the tomorrows unafraid.
Brian O'Donovan reporting there from Pennsylvania. More from Brian on the programme across the week, 7:48.
It may have lacked the glitz and the glamour of the red carpet, but Oscar-winning Hollywood director Martin Scorsese zoomed in, as did big-name stars like Ruth Negga and Chris O'Dowd. It was, of course, the IFTAs, the Irish Film and Television Awards, broadcast last night on Virgin Media One and hosted by Deirdre O'Kane. Watching it for us, our arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley. Before we talk to her, here's Scorsese.
I only wish I was there in person doing this evening to visit, to have an excuse to visit Dublin again, Ireland. And I really have fond memories of giving that IFTA masterclass in Dublin, which is so vivid in my mind. It feels like it was last week. And I remember at the end looking at everybody and looking at these brilliant Irish filmmakers and telling them, now is your time. Now's your time. Go make film. Tell stories with the moving image. Reinvent cinema. Reinvent it. Of course, little did we all know what strange times lay ahead, as we're witnessing now. And it appears to me that we're all having to reinvent cinema now. And that's a good thing. It is.
Martin Scorsese there and Sinead Crowley, he wishes he was there. We wish he was there as well, and all of the other stars. They were not. They were all remote. How did it go? It celebrated television and film.
It actually went very well, considering this is obviously something that all of the award ceremonies are having to relearn this year. And what IFTA did was they kept it fairly simple, Deirdre O'Kane presenting the programme and then most of the stars zooming in. But they did get a really good lineup of stars. And I suppose the only one strange positive in all of this is that people are available and they're there on Zoom. And so there was very little of that. Well, she couldn't be here to present the award. They were actually all there, even though it was remotely. So you had Andrew Scott, you had, as you heard there, Martin Scorsese, you had Jesse Buckley, who won two awards. You had all the big stars and you had that contact with them. So went very smoothly and went very well. There were two films in the best film category because they actually awarded 2019 and 2020 last night. So Ordinary Love won best film 2020, and then Black 47, the famine drama, won best film 2019. Other than that, then the big winners in the night included Tom Vaughan Lawler, who won best actor for Rialto. Jesse Buckley, as I mentioned there, won two. She won best actress in a film and best supporting actress for Chernobyl. And Liam Neeson also, he stars in Ordinary Love, and he also spoke on Zoom and talked about, you know, best wishes to people back home. And that's something else that a lot of people spoke about as well, just sending best wishes to the industry, you know, because as we know, the arts in general and then film in this particular case has been so badly hit by COVID. So people really, there was that sense of solidarity and people sending best wishes and hoping that the industry would come through it.
Sinead Crowley, our arts and media correspondent, thank you very much.
Retail Excellence has urged the government to classify all retail stores as essential so that they can stay open in the run-up to Christmas. Under Level 4 and 5, only essential shops such as supermarkets and chemists are allowed to remain open. Managing Director of Retail Excellence, Duncan Graham, joins us. Good morning, Duncan.
Good morning, Sheila.
We know more restrictions are on the way. If the government doesn't heed your call and non-essential retailers have to close, what will it mean for those businesses?
This is impact at this time of the year until Christmas. And this is going to be difficult for particularly the smaller non-food retailers who are not yet trading online. You know, we've been talking to government ministers now since early September about how concerned we are about further lockdowns and the need for all retail to remain essential. And we estimate at the moment there are probably 30,000 retail workers on the PUP scheme. If we're to have further restrictions, we believe there's potentially another 60,000 jobs that could be lost, not to mention the 10,000 temporary seasonal jobs that usually happen around this time of the year. And in addition to that, we know that there have been at least 90 high-profile store closures across the country during the course of this year. So if there are further restrictions, there will inevitably be more permanent store closures, and that's likely to happen at the very earliest, the start of 2021.
Do you know if infection rates are high among staff working in retail?
Well, that's just the thing. You know, we're very aware that there isn't much coming through from retail at the moment. I mean, you know, retailers have basically done everything that's been asked of them up to now, right from the beginning of the outbreak back in March. You know, we've done everything that's been asked of us. We've opened up slowly. We've implemented physical distancing. We've put hand sanitization. You know, all of those measures, the face covering issues and so on, all of those things have been put in place. And there is very little evidence that there's anything coming from retail. You know, if you look around Europe at the moment, we seem to be the only country that is anticipating closing down essential or non-essential retailing at this time of the year, which feels crazy to us at this moment in time.
And if retailers close and then reopen, we'll say at the end of November, there's likely going to be an influx of people to stores to do their Christmas shopping. Will retailers be able to manage that in terms of COVID safety?
Yes, look, we'll do our best. But as you say, you know, there will be potentially less than 4 weeks to go before Christmas if that happens. And, you know, I can only describe Christmas shopping at that point will be frenzied. You know, I'm really concerned about how busy it could be and how difficult it could be to control an outbreak of cases at that point. You know, we've actually had a significant surge to online shopping. And all that's going to happen with this further lockdown is that we will push more people online. That means that, you know, potentially up to 70% of that spend will be taken out of the country. It could cost the economy up to $5 billion. You know, and really what we're looking for from government is make all retail essential at this crucial time of the year and allow retail businesses to trade smoothly up until the Christmas period. That must surely be a better way of doing it than simply, you know, reopening and creating a shopping frenzy in the final 4 weeks.
Okay, and Retail Ireland, your colleagues with the IBEC group that represents the Irish retail sector said any move to close down retail deemed non-essential would be a massive blow to the sector. So everybody on the same page there. Duncan Graham from Retail Excellence, thank you for your time this morning. Elsewhere, Instagram is being investigated over its handling of children's personal data. I'll have more at that at 8:30. But for now, back to you, Mary.
Some very wet and at times windy weather expected for the next 24 to 36 hours, with a yellow rainfall warning in effect for the whole country for today and much of tomorrow. Today will be a wet and blustery day, with outbreaks of rain spreading northwards over the country. The rain will become heavy in some areas, with a risk of localised flooding, with highest accumulations expected in mountainous areas of the west and northwest. Highest temperatures today of 12 to 14 degrees in fresh to strong south to southeast winds. Further spells of heavy rain spreading northwards over the country tonight, with a continuing risk of localised flooding. The rain will turn more showery in nature later in the night, with some clear spells developing, becoming very windy in southern coastal counties with gales expected along coasts, and lows tonight of 10 to 12 degrees. Tomorrow, Tuesday, will be a windy day with showery outbreaks of rain extending across the country. Further heavy downpours are expected with isolated thunderstorms and a risk of localised flooding. Highest temperatures tomorrow of 13 to 15 degrees. Strong and gusty south or southwest winds bringing a risk of coastal flooding in some areas. And it'll remain unsettled for the rest of the week, with low pressure never far from our shores, but nothing too inclement. Showers on Wednesday and Thursday, but a lot of dry weather too, but it will turn chilly, with northerly breezes keeping daytime highs to just 10 or 11 degrees. So just to recap, outbreaks of rain in all areas today, with the rain turning heavy at times, bringing a risk of some localised flooding. That's all from me. Have a great day.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, October the 19th, and this is Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson and Audrey Carville. The news is read by Brian Jennings.
The Cabinet will meet today to finalise a new range of COVID-19 restrictions, which it's anticipated will close down the retail sector for at least a month and further limit social engagement. It's expected the new measures will contain elements of both Level 4 and Level 5 restrictions from the government's Living with COVID-19 plan. Public Expenditure Minister Michael McGrath said yesterday that the government accepts the need to provide certainty and will do just that. The opposition has called for additional supports for those affected by any further public health measures. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
A high-powered cabinet subcommittee involving the three coalition party leaders plus senior ministers will gather at government buildings this morning. Their aim will be to narrow differences on the new COVID-19 plan ahead of a crucial cabinet meeting this afternoon, which will take profound decisions for the country. It's understood the plan will contain elements of both Level 4 and Level 5 restrictions, constraining commercial activity, as well as limiting social engagement. It's expected most shops will close, along with amenities like gyms, and there could be additional travel restrictions. Opposition parties are broadly supportive of increasing restrictions. The Sinn Féin health spokesman David Cullinan said he would support all public health interventions, but added social supports must be put in place for vulnerable people and cuts to the PUP must be reversed. However, the Aonthu leader Padraig Tobin said the cabinet needed to aim high in terms of hospital capacity, but cautious in terms of restrictions.
The total number of confirmed COVID-19 infections to date in Ireland is expected to surpass 50,000 today, as the number of cases continues to increase. One third of the latest cases were in Dublin. County Cavan continues to have the highest 14-day incidence rate of the virus. Laura Hogan reports.
A total of 1,283 new cases of COVID-19 were reported on Sunday, spread across all 26 counties. Of these, more than a third of the new cases, or 408, were in Dublin. The 14-day incidence rate of the virus is now 251 for the country. Cavan continues to have the highest rate of the virus, followed by Meath, Monaghan, Donegal and Clare. Of the new cases, nearly 70% are aged under 45.
The chief negotiators for the European Union and the UK will speak by phone today, following the fallout from last week's EU summit in Brussels. It prompted a declaration by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson that the UK should now prepare for a post-Brexit no-trade deal situation. However, despite the negative UK reaction, there are expectations that negotiations between the two sides could resume later in the week. Separately in London, there will be a meeting of EU-UK Joint Committee, which will focus in particular on the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Gardaí have upgraded the investigation into the disappearance of Jojo Dollard 25 years ago to a murder investigation. The 21-year-old went missing after making a call at a public phone box in Moon, County Kildare, on the 9th of November 1995, as she was making her way home to Callan in County Kilkenny. The status of the case changed following an examination by the Serious Crime Review Team. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
While it was long suspected that Jojo Dollard came to some harm when she disappeared without a trace 25 years ago, this has now been officially and formally recognised with the upgrading of this missing persons case to one of murder. 21-year-old Jojo was working in Callan in County Kilkenny when on Thursday the 9th of November 1995 she went to Dublin. She missed the last direct bus home that night, got a bus to Naas, and then hitched two lifts and got to Moon in County Kildare. While she was in the phone box there telling a friend where she was, a car stopped for her, and that was the last anyone heard from Jojo Dollard. The case was examined by the Serious Crime Review Team following a meeting between Jojo's sister Kathleen Bergen and the Garda Commissioner. The investigation has now been upgraded to a murder inquiry. The Gardaí and the family will later today renew their appeal for anyone with information on Jojo's disappearance and violent death to come forward and help establish what happened to the young woman and who killed her.
A growing number of people are being subjected to financial abuse since COVID restrictions were implemented, according to research published this morning by the Banking and Payments Federation and Safeguarding Ireland. During lockdown, many people needed assistance to manage their money or access funds. Here's our consumer affairs correspondent, Fran McNulty.
Two-thirds of people who needed help from others to manage their money during the COVID-19 lockdown have not yet taken back control of their own finances. 1,000 people were surveyed by Red Sea for the Banking and Payments Federation and Safeguarding Ireland. 1 in 20 people surveyed experienced financial abuse during the lockdown. 13% were concerned that someone might take advantage of them financially. 12% experienced less control of their finances since the pandemic began. Safeguarding Ireland works to protect vulnerable adults. This morning, its advice is clear. take back control of your own finances if you can. It's a sad statistic that more than 10% of people are dishonest in how they manage a vulnerable person's finances. Those concerned should contact their bank or post office and ask to speak to someone.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Ulster Bank. Thinking of switching your mortgage? The Ulster Bank mortgage team are available to talk. Hail, rain or shine.
Wet and blustery today with outbreaks of rain spreading northwards over the country. The rain will become heavy in some areas with a risk of localised flooding, especially in the southwest, west and northwest, with a heightened risk of flash flooding in mountainous regions. Highest temperatures 12 to 14 degrees. There's a warning that southerly winds will reach gale force tonight on Irish coastal waters from Dungarvan to Mizenhead to Valentia.
New COVID-19 restrictions expected to be announced today are the main topic for most papers. It will be level 4 plus nationwide for 3 to 4 weeks, says the Irish Times. The paper quotes one minister as saying there is general agreement that schools should remain open no matter what. That was also the view of the National Public Health Emergency Team, NPHET, the unnamed source said. November pain, says the Irish Daily Star headline, predicting a revised level 4 lockdown. Lockdown will save Christmas, says the Irish Daily Mail. For our own good is the headline in the Irish Sun, which spells it F-O-U-R. The paper reckons that all pubs are set to shut and schools could be closed. The Irish Independent believes that schools and creches will remain open and describes what is in prospect as a merger of level 4 and level 5 restrictions. It is expected, Philip Ryan writes, that the three government leaders with their senior ministers, who meet Tony Houlihan and Paul Reid this morning, will reject NPHET's suggestion of a 6-week lockdown and instead opt for between 3 and 4 weeks. As for the reason for all these restrictions, the Irish Daily Mirror reports in its lead story on what it calls a super spreader, who infected at least 56 people after catching COVID-19 abroad. As revealed in a report published by the Health Service Executive Midwest, the man failed to self-isolate, leading to 10 households and players on a sports team getting coronavirus. That story is carried in detail on the front page of The Times as well. The case is described by the HSE as a real example of how COVID-19 can quickly spread within the community. The Irish Examiner leads with the report that there are now almost 200 fewer permanent nurses working in the health system than before the pandemic. The Labour Party leader, Alan Kelly, is quoted describing the figures as absolutely shocking in the middle of a global pandemic. The Belfast Telegraph leads with the tributes paid to 18-year-old Josh Fletcher from Moira, County Down, who died yesterday after his car left the road when it struck a cow. The paper notes, as a child, he underwent a life-saving bone marrow transplant thanks to tissue from his sister. On the matter of linguistics and spelling, a letter to the editor of The Independent makes a singular and short point. Thanks for putting fathers on Irish words. The articles read much better with them. So writes Áine Monaghan, address with editor, who has given her a capital A father. On the wildlife front, the wolves of Loch Gill are considered in the Examiner. Dan McCarthy writes that a UCC geography lecturer, Kieran Hickey, has identified places called Wolf Island in counties Armagh, Derry, Down and Sligo. Sligo's Wolf Island lies close to the shore in Loch Gill, is heavily wooded and is probably in the same condition today as it was when the last wolf was killed in Ireland in 1786, says McCarthy. A peninsula where the Garavogue River meets the lake is only about 20 metres from Wolf Island and would have been an easy embarkation point for the wolves to swim across to safety from people. He quotes Dr. Hickey as saying, like dogs, wolves are excellent swimmers.
the government will decide today what increased COVID-19 restrictions we will all face in the days and weeks ahead. Higher Education Minister Simon Harris said they were needed because Level 3 restrictions were not working. The National Public Health Emergency Team has recommended that the country move to Level 5 for 6 weeks. Last Thursday night, they said that unless things changed, there would be 2,500 cases by the end of this month, 400 people in hospital, with up to 110 of them in ICU. They described the situation as dangerous and the virus was not in control. Latest figures last night showed that 1,283 confirmed new cases here and three more deaths. In the north, five more people died and 1,012 new cases were confirmed. We're joined on the line now by Minister of State for European Affairs, Thomas Byrne. Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
And you're very welcome. Level 4 plus seems to be the consensus across the papers this morning for up to 4 weeks. Is that what you're expecting?
Well, what's happened, I think, as you know, is that NPHET has written to the government, and the government in terms of the party leaders and the finance ministers and the health minister have discussed this with them on Saturday. Indeed, discussions continued yesterday. The Cabinet Subcommittee on COVID, as I understand it, is meeting this morning. And then the decision will be taken by government then, I presume, later this afternoon. I think that there is a meeting scheduled for later this afternoon. But I think that that is necessary because, yes, what our objective is to do everything possible to protect lives and livelihoods. I think it is incumbent on the government to consider every single possible ramification of this before it's done, because there is obviously a significant financial cost to the state in terms of further restrictions, particularly at the retail sector and the amount of people who will, you know, hopefully temporarily lose their jobs. But there's a big hit to the economy here, and that has to be paid for. And I think that that's the type of consideration that's been ongoing. I will say this is that I think from day one in office, the Taoiseach has been absolutely determined to open schools, and it is absolutely the determination that schools and childcare settings would remain open. I want to make
and,
that
and do you think that will remain the case under whatever restrictions are announced later on today, or should schools take that extra week after midterm?
Well, I don't know who has proposed the extra week after midterm, but the government position is that schools wouldn't be closed unnecessarily. Yes, there have been some outbreaks involving students at schools, but by and large, schools are safe places. Within COVID, I think the consequences of our children not having an education for a prolonged period of time, as we had earlier in the year, is really devastating to young people. And I think that it has to be avoided at all costs. And I think that that is the common determination, not just of the government, but also of the medical advisors and indeed of NPHET, as I understand it.
But why should teachers be exposed? If the rest of us are being told to stay at home, to have our contacts, to reduce our contacts, why expose teachers in rooms full of children from dozens and dozens of different households?
Well, I'm not sure that I accept your premise. I mean, I don't think anybody is talking about exposing teachers or indeed SNAs, and I want to thank them sincerely for the work that they are doing in keeping our schools going, keeping our children's education going. They're doing incredible work. But any decisions that have been taken in relation to schools, in relation to education, have been taken on medical advice. And I don't think any medical advice has been rejected in the context of schools. What we're hoping to do, I know the Taoiseach is determined to get antigen testing rolled out. It has been rolled out, for example, in France. And that is a game changer, particularly with regards to schools, that if there is an issue in a school, that antigen testing can resolve it much more quickly in terms of getting a result. I know that will help the situation. But everything that has been done in relation to schools has been done with the best interest, not just of our children in mind, but also the staff working in schools in mind as well.
Okay. Whatever is announced later on today, the big question is around enforcement. Because last time when we went to level three, GAA matches were allowed with hundreds of people attending. I mean, the dogs in the street knew that hundreds of people were going to various matches across the country. Christenings continued, communions, parties, all continued without enforcement. How will that be different this time?
Well, look, we're never going to get a situation where the Gardaí can be sent to every single breach of a COVID restriction. The most important part of the COVID restrictions actually is the social solidarity, where people voluntarily do things themselves. And that then requires, and that's why the government's been thinking about this over the weekend, that requires government supports, obviously, for people who've lost their jobs, for tenants, for renters. All those sorts of issues have to be considered. But it is the social solidarity, the feeling that we're all doing this for everybody's benefit,
But that's not really there this time, is it, Minister? Really? I mean, many of us are operating almost at level five and have been for the last number of months, but a significant section have not been.
Well, look, what I'm afraid of actually and generally is that the stigma or blame game that is going on in many local areas throughout the country, because that actually I think has negative effects then on the pandemic, because people might be embarrassed to report symptoms. I think we always have to go back to basics on this, that if you have symptoms, you need to self-isolate, you need to ring your GP, you need to get care. If you're in a household with somebody who has symptoms, you need to restrict your movements as well. I think if we all get back to the basics in terms of the basics that our doctors and experts have told us time and time again, that can help. But really, the enforcement will get us so far. It is about everybody looking out for everybody else. And I think the government obviously has to take a lead on that. But there is a responsibility at every level of the population on that as well.
Over 100,000 more people are expected to lose their jobs by going to level four with the closure, expected closure of non-essential work, non-essential retail. Will the pandemic unemployment payment therefore be restored to €350 for the top rate to give people a further cushion to get through these next number of weeks?
Well, that's a key issue that's under consideration this weekend by the government. We were asked by Sinn Féin to take an immediate decision, I think, on Friday night or Saturday night on this. But you cannot just immediately say, without thinking through the consequences, that over 100,000 people are possibly going to lose their job, we hope temporarily, immediately. And that's why there's been detailed consideration going on. What are the supports in place? And you mentioned that enforcement, and I said social solidarity. We won't have that unless we have the supports in place. And they are exactly the considerations that government is considering today, yesterday, the day before a final decision is made, to make sure that we protect the health of the population, but also protect the country as economically as we can. We
and
had a budget last week.
Will there be a ban on evictions? Sorry, Minister, just to ask you this very important question, because there was a ban on evictions during the last pandemic, and yet during those months, March to June, 374 people were evicted.
Well, there is still a ban on evictions, by the way, and a rent freeze for those who are economically affected by the pandemic. I would expect that the restrictions will be brought even tighter and much stronger, in fact, than they are anywhere else, I think. Certainly on these islands, and much stronger than Northern Ireland, we're going to make sure that they don't happen. They shouldn't have happened. There was a ban there. They shouldn't go to court. We saw some egregious examples of people being turfed out in the street completely illegally. And there should be legal consequences then for landlords who do that in breach of the law.
OK, we will leave it there for now. Many thanks for joining us this morning. Minister of State for European Affairs, Thomas Byrne of Fianna Fáil, 8:20.
Sinn Féin President Mary Lou MacDonald, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mary.
And you've said you would go wherever necessary to protect people's lives. Will you support the government's commitment to act decisively today, whether that's level four plus or level five?
Well, not alone will we support it. In fact, I think it'd be a matter of some relief for people to have clarity on this matter. I don't think a weekend of speculation and wondering and worrying has been of any assistance to people. So we need a decision. Of course, it needs to be a considered, balanced decision, and it needs to be communicated clearly. And we've made the point time and again, Mary, as you know, that additional restrictions, whatever they are, have to be matched by additional supports and protections. And you were talking to the Minister there about buy-in, about social solidarity. Our strong view is that respecting the fact that people are going to struggle with new restrictions and offering the support that the state can financially and in terms of the security of the roof over their head is, I think, a very direct way to build in a positive way that sense of social cohesion and to rekindle perhaps that often used phrase that we are all in this together.
And within the restrictions, whatever they are to come late, when they come later today, do you support restrictions continuing for a four-week period or a six-week period, as NPHET has recommended, which would take us right to the start of December?
Yeah, I think that would be really, really challenging and difficult for all of us. But I also know that as we speak, Mary, the virus is growing exponentially. I heard the conversation earlier on with the doctor from the matter, and I know that many hospitals are reporting that ICU intensive care is not under huge pressure at this point. But I also know that last week in 13 hospitals, public hospitals across the state, there was no intensive care capacity available. The numbers and the data don't lie. There are certain things in this pandemic that are unpredictable and unknowable. But what is very predictable is the fact that this virus spreads really, really quickly. It spreads exponentially, as the experts say. And in fact, so predictable is it that they can actually map out where we will be if we continue on the path that we're on. So I think that reality, Mary, shapes all other decisions. Mm. That reality of keeping people well and safe and alive, quite frankly, and also ensuring only a matter of what, 9 or 10 weeks to Christmas, that people who are going to really struggle and who are, as we're speaking this morning, many of them worried, sick, that the state acts to restore the PUP and the wage subsidy scheme, by the way, reinstates an absolute ban on evictions, and that mortgage holders are not left at the mercy of banks.
And the question of how far these restrictions will go now, nobody is talking about closing schools or creches. What about building sites? What about construction work? And are you in agreement to close down all but the most essential of retail outlets? We're down to supermarkets. Do you keep off licences open?
Well, look, we accept that additional measures need to be introduced, Mary. And just bear in mind, the government gets correctly very deep briefing from NPHET. They're in a position to assess and measure and weigh, not as a matter of opinion, but as a matter of data and science, what steps might be taken and their likely outcome over what period of time. The opposition, and as leader of the opposition, I'm not privy to all of that. Mm. So what I can say to you is that I absolutely accept that we're in a grave situation and we need strong measures. Just on the issue of schools, Mary, we have two sets of advice on the island of Ireland, one in the north, one in the south. The advice in the north that the executive followed was to close the schools. The advice in this jurisdiction is to keep them open. Can I make the point again that it is extremely unhelpful? In fact, I believe that it is dangerous. I think it's not good for the protection of public health that we have two different approaches, two different strategies, in some cases two different and in this case conflicting pieces of public health advice. And we have long argued for an all-Ireland, a really national approach to keep people on the island safe.
Indeed,
we're not there
you
yet,
indeed, Mary Lou MacDonald and many others as well. Can I ask you briefly and finally about another story in the Irish Times this morning? Sinn Féin received a donation of $4 million from an English man. He left it to you in his will, William Hampton, you told the Standards in Public Office they couldn't scrutinise this donation because this was a donation, it's in Northern Ireland and the party operates on a 6 and 26 county basis. Are there two Sinn Féins?
No, there's one Sinn Féin and all monies that are received by us are completely in compliance with the rules and with the law. That's it, and that's the standard that we meet. And that's the standard that all others meet also. And I would suggest to you, Mary, this morning, as we're awaiting decisions that are really going to have huge implications for people's jobs and their businesses, for their lives, for their social lives, I'm not convinced that Sinn Féin and that particular donation, which you've covered extensively,
indeed,
number one on their priority.
It is a significant amount of money, but just this, does it mean the money is used exclusively then for Sinn Féin in the six counties?
Well, there are rules for where monies can be used, and yes, that is the case. That's always been the case, and I've discussed it at length many times with some of your colleagues on RTÉ. The rules will be obeyed. The rules will be kept, the regulations will be respected and kept by Sinn Féin, wherever funds are raised.
Sinn Féin President Mary Lou MacDonald, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland.
Gardaí have upgraded the investigation into the disappearance of Jojo Dollard 25 years ago to a murder investigation. Let's hear a clip of a news report from the time she disappeared.
The last reported contact of 21-year-old Josephine Dollard was when it's claimed she called a friend, Mary Cullinan, at around 11:15 p.m. on Thursday last from the Kildare village of Moon. She was having problems hitching a lift but said she would call when she arrived home.
Well, let's talk to our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds, now. Paul, 25 years ago this happened. Will you just fill us in from what happened back then?
That's correct, Audrey. Jojo Dollard was 21 years of age when she disappeared. She was a lively, popular, happy young woman. At the time, she had moved to Callan in County Kilkenny into a new job to work in Granger's restaurant there. She decided to go to Dublin on Thursday, the 9th of November 1995. She had worked in the city previously, and it's believed she was clearing up her affairs there before her move to Kilkenny. Now, she missed the last direct bus home that night. She got another bus to Naas. She hitched a lift to Kilcullen and then another lift on to Moon. And while she was in Moon, as you heard there in that report from Michael Lally, she called her friend Mary Cullinan from a phone box in the village to tell her where she was. Now, when she was on the phone to Mary, a car passed. The family believed that Jojo may have flagged that car down. Her sister Kathleen says that Jojo came back to Mary and said, "I have a lift. I'll phone you again at my next stop." That was the last place she was seen or heard from. The family say that phone call meant they were able to verify that Jojo had got as far as Moon, but it's after Moon that they were trying to put the pieces together. The area was searched. There was an intensive investigation. Jojo's case was looked at over the years. It was part of Operation Trace in the 1990s, which was set up to look at the cases of six missing women in 1998. There have been numerous appeals for information in the case of Jojo Dollard throughout the years, but the case remains unsolved.
It's a case which really has stayed with people for all of that time. So what's likely to happen today, Paul?
Well, it is a significant announcement today by the Gardaí that they have upgraded this to a murder investigation. Now, they obviously won't disclose everything about their inquiries, but they have carried out, they say they have carried out proof of life inquiries. They're satisfied that Jojo came to serious harm. Today, there'll be a joint appeal in County Kildare by the Gardaí and Jojo's family. Her sister Mary and her brother Tom passed away not knowing what happened to her, but her sister Kathleen is expected to be at the press conference today in Newbridge. There'll obviously be a general appeal for information, asking for people for information on what's already known, her last movements, what she was wearing. She was last seen wearing black jeans and black white top, black shoes, and of course the last phone call was just after 11:30 that night. But interestingly enough, there seems to be a new line of inquiry in the sense that the Gardaí are also seeking information on a Sony Walkman, or a Sanyo Walkman, should I say. They believe that Jojo Dollard had a Sanyo Walkman with her that night. Now, for younger people, a Walkman was a portable cassette radio player with headphones. That hasn't been found. The Gardaí are actively looking for that, and they believe it went everywhere with Jojo. And if they find that, or if they find information in relation to that Sanyo Walkman, that could be the key, or a key, to progressing this investigation.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much indeed. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds, there.
Retail Excellence has urged the government to classify all retail stores as essentials so that they can stay open in the run-up to Christmas. IBEC Group Retail Ireland says any move to close down retail deemed non-essential would be a massive blow to the sector. Instagram is being investigated by Ireland's Data Protection Commissioner over its handling of children's personal data on the platform. The investigation stems from complaints that Instagram made contact information on business accounts publicly visible to anyone accessing the app. Average house prices rose by 4.8% between June and September this year, according to the latest house price report from daft.ie. House prices rose 11% in Waterford City, 10% in Galway City, and 9% in Cork and Limerick cities. By comparison, prices rose by 2.2% in Dublin. The number of homes on sale is at a 14-year low, which has pushed up prices. On the currencies, 1 euro buys 90.5 pence sterling and 1 US dollar 17 cents.
And at 8:36, it's good morning again to Darren.
Good morning, Audrey. Well, the inter-county season returned after a seven-month break over the weekend. I was involved myself yesterday on the Sunday Sport programme here on RTE Radio 1. And I have to admit, one of the strangest weekends ever. On one hand, we had all the excitement of having Gaelic games back. And then on the other, wondering if the plug could be pulled today as the threat of COVID hangs over us all. So on the field, we got lots of drama and off it, lots of talking points and some very strong views.
It's face coverings and hand sanitizer all around here in Inneskeen as the inter-county scene makes its long-awaited return to action at Grattan Park.
But we can't ignore what has been happening over the past 24 hours, not least of all Leitrim choosing not to travel to Down. How important is it that everything goes off well?
Critical, I'd say. The mood of the naysayers, I would say, is not good. I'm
certain that the standards and the protocols and what has to be adhered to, I's dotted and T's crossed, there's no doubt about that. Then you need a good dose of luck.
You just cannot beat class.
Obviously, a lot of people have reservations about what's going on. All we can do is try and live with this thing, and this is part of our makeup. This is part of our DNA to be here, to be involved in football, and whether it's club football or inter-county football. And I know the people in Kerry have been really looking forward to today. And look, I'm glad we got a bit of a result for them, and I hope they enjoyed watching it.
Leitrim handed down a walkover due to a number of COVID contacts in their squad, and manager Terry Hyland expressed surprise that his squad was the only one in that position this weekend.
We experienced some level of difficulty because, in the end of the day, it's in every parish and it's in every town down in the country. So it would seem very unusual if somebody else and other counties are not having the problem.
I think the whole integrity of the league is damaged after what Leitrim did yesterday. There was no mention of how many cases or anything like that. I thought it was very, very poor. Not only did it affect the bottom of the league, it certainly affected the top of the league. I think there's a lot of people very, very disappointed.
Penalty for Martin Riley for Cavan, and a superb save by the Kildare goalkeeper Mark Donlan.
Obviously, we're taking every precaution. We have a player who tested positive, so he's away from the group. It's probably only a matter of time before there are problems, you know.
Now, you heard the voices there of Kevin McStay, Peter Keane, Terry Hyland, David Power and Jack O'Connor, and some of my RTE colleagues across all the platforms over the weekend. Joining me now is Tomás O'Shea. Tomás, let's get straight into it and talk about those comments from David Power, the Tipperary manager. The integrity of the league was damaged, not happy with what was happening in Leitrim over the weekend. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, well, I think the lads covered it on RTE last night on the league Sunday show, Ireland. They basically said we don't know the actually ins and outs of it. But I suppose David Power's point was that Fermanagh, with a similar situation where they lost 17 to close contacts and actual COVID situations, and they came down, they fulfilled their fixture, and Terry Hyland came out very, very late. Leitrim came out very late. And I think he was just looking for clarity. How many people were actually affected by it? Could they not have fulfilled the fixture? Did they avail of the rapid testing that the GAA now put in front of every team? Darren, I think, you know, a lot of people worry and a lot of people have an argument that the GAA is not an essential sport. And if it is to go ahead, it is categorised in the professional sport and elite sports category. So in that vein, it should go ahead. But I do think the GAA could help themselves and help all the naysayers that if they have a testing system weekly, if they could get the players tested weekly, no matter what, if there's a worry or not a worry, I think it gives everybody confidence. It gives the backroom team confidence, but it gives the public confidence, and it can be done. And I suppose the big argument, Darren, is it needed? Does it have to be played? The big argument against the GAA will be saying that these are amateur players and why are you putting them in danger? And I would actually say that if the government, and they will be decisive today, I've no doubt about that, but if they open up half the country or more for an economic reason, I think there is a valid reason that the championship and the league should go through. We saw over the weekend how careful everything was, how professional everything was. Listening to Wayne Cairns of Louth and Ronan McCarthy about how they prepared before the matches, the extent they went to it, we saw it on television. I think it can be. But the bigger point, and everybody's saying I'm speaking from a selfish point of view, and I might be, but you can see it in the community, and I do think, and people laugh at the fact that it's a mental health issue. There are a couple of 100,000 people, and if the championship went ahead, the lift it would give them. I see the gyms are signing a petition for mental well-being to keep the gyms open. I do think that sport going ahead should go ahead if it's safe, and I believe it can go ahead, and I believe it can be done safely as well.
Now, the big worry, Tomás, is if it gets the go-ahead today and we continue on like this, if the situation, the national situation, gets worse, that it has to be pulled, what happens then?
Yeah, well, if it has to be pulled, Darren, you see, whatever's going to happen this evening, I mean, an argument that can be made is, do you pull it this evening and pull the whole lot, or do you have this uncertainty going forward? And I don't like the uncertainty going forward, but that's the way life is for everybody at the moment. And if it's a case where, if everything is pulled, I'd have no issue with it. And, you know, I'm a school teacher and I'm heading into a class right now with 30 other people inside in the class. And, you know, I do think if certain things can be done safely, you continue on with it. You can't say this is the contradictions in what has been done up till now, I don't think is right. And I do believe that whatever they decide this evening, that they should go to it. Another point would be that, look, everybody's comparing intra-county to club and what happened at club, and what happened at club on a lot of levels was wrong after matches, and I agree with that. But you have to think as well, Darren, that in about 2 weeks or 3 weeks' time, there'll only be 8 teams left in this hurling and football championship, that week by week, there will not be the numbers involved that are involved. And yes, as a weekend, I think it was a success in terms of the way it was ran off. Yes, and there's nobody in the GAA saying that we're bigger or better or more important than anybody else. If the government say that we have to pull it, then we have to pull it and we have to accept that. There is no doubt about it. But I'd stick to the view, and I'd argue that, to put the point, that if other areas of society are safe, then in my opinion, the GAA have proven that they can run things as safely as anybody else that are expected to go into our communities.
Tomás, good talking to you as always. Let's hope we're talking again over the course of the next few weeks. Details of all the football results of the weekend available online. Check it out, rte.ie. In hurling, Antrim beat Kerry by 3 points, so they're back up to Division 1. Down overcame Derry in Division 2B decider. Sligo beat Leitrim in the Division 3B final. In the Littlewoods Camogie Championship, wins for Galway and Tipperary. But the story of the weekend was the win for Westmeath on Saturday. Their senior debut just 3 years ago, they were competing at junior level. So well done to them. Katie McCabe scored an absolute cracker as Arsenal beat Tottenham 6-1 in the WSL yesterday. Stunning goal for the Gunners. They continue their great start of the season. And great to see in that sort of form as well, ahead of what is a massive week for Irish soccer. The Ireland women's team play Ukraine on Friday in the Euro qualifiers. Last night's Premier League action, West Ham produced quite the comeback, came from 3-0 down to draw 3-3 with Tottenham. 3-0 down with 8 minutes to go, but somehow they managed to claw their way back into it. And speaking of injury time winners, Aston Villa could continue their great start to the campaign. They had a 1-0 win at Leicester City. Ross Barkley scored a dramatic late winner, and the Villa fans have been in touch with me this morning and they're enjoying their moment, and they wanted to point it out that the Villa, for the record, have won their opening 4 top flight games for the first time in 90 years, and it puts them second in the standings, just a point off Everton, who are top. Liverpool's Virgil van Dijk needs surgery on a knee injury. It's unclear how serious it is, but some reports that a season could be over. Shelburne are all but safe following a 1-0 win against Sligo Rovers in the SSE or Trinity League Premier Division. Gary Deegan with the only goal, and it was a nice move too.
Kilduff gets the cross in. Lovely dummy. What a goal. Gary Deegan arriving on cue. Set up by that delightful cross from Kieran Kilduff. And Deegan has his third goal of the campaign to make it Shelburne 1, Sligo Rovers 0.
And finally, we'll finish with the golf. Jason Kokrak won the CJ Cup in Las Vegas. Rory McIlroy just outside the top 20, and a great finish, a best ever finish for Jonathan Caldwell on the European Tour, 7th yesterday at the Scottish Championship. That's your sport for now.
And we're coming back to what's in store today now in terms of further and deeper restrictions to tackle the continuing rising COVID-19 around the country. Our reporter, Fiacra O'Kenny, is in Bray this morning. Good morning, Fiacra.
Good morning, Mary. Now, as we've just heard from yourself, Mary, in just a few hours' time, Cabinet will decide on new COVID-19 restrictions, including the possible return of lockdown. Now, in a moment, we'll hear from businesses which may be affected by the decision. But firstly, I was speaking with locals in Bray, County Wicklow this morning about their views on what should happen next.
I think we do need some sort of lockdown. Cases were coming down nicely. Kids went back to school in September. All of a sudden, the cases went up. That to me would say, okay, we opened schools, cases went up, so schools need to be looked at. But yet they're all they're talking about was keeping schools open and closing everything else. I own Supreme Altitude in Bray. I've had to put in 20 grand worth of building individual pods. I've glass pods in there, so everybody that comes to the gym walks in their masks, sanitize their hands before they go in. They go into their pod. We're very safe at the minute, but it cost me 20 grand. I only opened back up 2 weeks ago, and I'm being told now that I could have to close again tomorrow. It's heartbreaking.
Probably long overdue, to be honest. I mean, they've already been told this weeks, months ago by NPHET, and they didn't listen. So, I mean, I don't know. It's kind of damage control at this stage. It seems inevitable. So what can people do? Like, it's unfortunate. I'm not happy about it.
I think we should go into another lockdown because cases are as high as ever. With schools being open and pubs still being open, the cases are only going to rise.
I definitely didn't think it should have been as loose as it was before this. I think we should have gone into a stricter lockdown way earlier, but I know it's important to try and find the middle ground to live with COVID. I don't want it to be so strict that people will just go crazy once again that when it loosens. So
with pubs anyways, because I work in a pub, it's like they take one step forward and three steps back. Yeah. Like they had like people inside, outside, now only 15 in the beer garden, like, which is just, they just need to close pubs altogether, I think.
Do you have any views on similar people in your age group and what they might be up to?
There's like still house parties going on and they're like ignorantly like posting it all over social media and stuff.
Yeah, I think I'm the same. It just makes me feel really uneasy. I definitely wouldn't be one to be out partying or anything, like absolutely not. They almost seem proud of it, like posting all over social media, and it makes me feel really uncomfortable.
The views of locals from Bray County Wicklow this morning. Now, as I was saying, we are in Bray Town Hall and I'm joined now by two people who represent businesses. Now, Mick Lynn is from the Bray Chamber of Commerce and John Duggan is a local business owner, including the Martello Tower bar and pub in the town. Now, firstly, if I come to you, Mick, how did the first lockdown affect Bray Town and what are the concerns of businesses for a possible second lockdown?
Oh, there's a massive effect during the last first lockdown. I mean, we estimate about 90% of the businesses in the shopping area closed down. And, you know, the effect that it's had, obviously the employers are in this rolling situation, knowing when they could reopen their businesses and what type of measures that they had to put in place. So that was ongoing, and what kind of stock levels were to get in. Their fears this time is, like, will they be able to pay the bills? You know, what kind of working capital is going to be available? Are they going to be able to pay the rent? Are they going to be able to pay their staff when they eventually get back? And I suppose the big one, are they going to be able to be open for Christmas? That's the one of the biggest concerns.
Do you feel that businesses understand the need for a second lockdown but feel maybe more supports are needed?
I mean, the government have made it clear that for public health reasons, and I think businesses are 100% behind that reason of why they need to close down. Whether or not we need to see small retailers close, whether or not they are contributing to the problem, we're not too sure. But, you know, during the budget they announced, and we need to see more measures of what they can do to pay those bills, you know what I mean, that are going to fall due at the end of the month.
And John, you're obviously a local businessman. You own a number of businesses in Bray itself. How did you survive first time around? And what would you like to see happen second time around in terms of what government should do?
Good morning, Fiacra. First time around, it was all a big shock. So it was very hard on a lot of people, and most people just closed. I suppose this time around, we have a little bit more time and time to adapt and change a model, which a lot of people have done successfully. Now, that's easy for me to say. I have a hotel, so I'm able to move towards takeaway and stuff like that. I will be very anxious to hear our building sites staying open, because, again, there's lots of building sites around the local area, and that would be great for my bedroom sales and things like that. But overall, it's been really, really tough on businesses.
Perfect. So the views of businesses and locals from Bray County Wicklow, there's obviously a big issue coming down the tracks and there is a big decision for Cabinet to make in just a few hours' time. Back to you in the studio.
Now, a man who did not restrict his movements after returning here from abroad led to at least 56 people being infected with COVID-19. The stark example of how the virus can spread so quickly is revealed in a report by the HSE Midwest, which is published today. Our Midwest correspondent, Cathy Halloran, has seen it and she joins us now. So, Cathy, this guy came back from holiday. He had cold-like symptoms, but he continued with life as normal.
Yes, well, this index case, as he is referred to, was abroad on his holidays, but he did not restrict his movements as per the current HSE guidelines when he got home. Now, he had mild symptoms, including a runny nose and a mild sore throat. He checked his temperature. It was normal. He felt reassured by this and socialised with a group of friends. He later, however, tested positive for COVID-19. However, by this stage, he'd already infected a number of his friends. Three of these friends then went on to infect their families. Now, another friend of the group who he infected felt unwell and contacted her GP to arrange a COVID-19 test. Now, she had the test in the morning, but by the afternoon she felt a bit better and decided to go to a friend's party. After the party, she got her test result and it was positive. But by attending the party while waiting for her test result, she ended up infecting a number of other people, the report says. But also, the index case had a close extended family who visited each other's houses regularly. They were quite close. This led to some extended family members also getting infected with COVID-19. One of his extended family members, who had no symptoms whatsoever, what we describe as asymptomatic, he played a match with his local team and a number of his teammates were infected as a result. The team members then went on to affect a number of other people. So this is an example in this report by Dr. May Mannix, the Director of Public Health in the Midwest, showing that in total here in this case, 56 cases were infected from that one original index case, affecting up to 10 private households and a sports team. And the point that's made by Dr. Mannix is this shows how quickly the virus can spread with people not self-isolating and not minding the HSE guidelines to self-restrict their movements.
A very stark example indeed. Cathy, thank you very much indeed. Our Midwest correspondent there, Cathy Halloran.
And further restrictions for the entire country to be announced later on today. They're expected to be a mix of elements from level 4 and level 5 from the Living with COVID-19 framework. What can we expect then? Let's have a chat now with our reporter Laura Hogan. You've been looking at level 4, level 5 and a blending of the two. What are the key differences between them, Laura?
Yes, Mary. Well, there are some broad similarities and differences indeed between levels 4 and 5. So first, if we look at our social lives and our social contacts, at both level 4 and 5, the message is you should have no visitors to your home and there's to be no social or family gatherings in any other settings. At both levels, there's to be no organised indoor gatherings and all museums, art galleries and so on stay closed as they are now at level 3. The number of guests at a wedding is also the same at both levels 4 and 5, so that's a small number of people, just 6 guests. But when it comes to going out for a bite to eat, however, there is a difference. At level 4, outdoor dining is permitted for up to 15 people, but at level 5, bars and restaurants will go back to takeaway service only. Now, the overall message at level 4 is to stay within your own county, so there is some flexibility there for domestic travel, but it's far more strict at level 5, when stay at home is the mantra and only exercise within 5 kilometres from home is permitted. So that is harking back to the restrictions that we lived through in March and April. Exercise itself is another topic at level 4 and level 5. Gyms, leisure centres and pools are to close. So parents and students will be waiting to hear later this evening about what's going to happen to childcare and what's going to happen to schools. So at level 4, the plan very clearly says that the priority is to keep schools and childcare open, and this will be done with protective measures. But in level 5, it's a bit more vague, saying that this decision would be based on the situation and the evidence at the time. And finally, and very significantly for jobs and for the economy, at level 4 and level 5, only retailers and services that are deemed to be essential will stay open.
And just remind us about that, will you? The difference between essential or the description of essential and non-essential retail.
Well, the government has a list of essential retail outlets that it deems to be essential for level 4 only. It's a really long list, but it includes things like supermarkets, news agents, pharmacies, laundries, banks, post offices and so on. So they can all stay open at level 4. But for non-essential retail, maybe things like clothes shops, for instance, there is a provision that they can stay open for click and collect services if it can be managed appropriately within the public health guidelines. So that's at level 4. At level 5, the guideline says essential retail only. So it's not clear if that exact same list applies at level 5, but it's likely that retailers who were deemed essential in the first lockdown, we'll say, would be essential at level 5. But at both levels 4 and 5, other non-essential retail will close, along with personal services. So that's really bad news for the likes of hairdressers, beauticians and barbers. At either level 4 or 5, they will have to close. So people can find the lists of essential retailers and essential services online at gov.ie.
OK, did you give us care homes there?
At care homes, as it is now at level 3, there is no visitors permitted for care homes at either level 4 or 5.
OK, and people, every home has received the National Framework for Living with COVID-19, but you can check it out further at gov.ie/COVID-19. Laura Hogan, thank you very much. It's 2 minutes to 9.